Welcome to Oncology Today, Early Clinical Research Edition, a special program focused on drug development, early phase clinical trials, and the emerging role of B7-H3 targeted antibody drug conjugates as an example. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love, and for this program, I met with Dr. Manish Patel, the Director of Drug Development of the Florida Cancer Specialists, also known as FCS, in Sarasota, Florida. To begin, Dr. Patel commented on his career focus and work with the FCS.
I see myself as a drug developer, right? And so I'm a medical oncologist, hematologist, board certified in both. I see all cancers, but 100% of the patients that I see are on clinical trials. So I oversee our early phase drug development program. So I PI a good number of our phase one trials. I direct our whole phase one program. And we have three phase one units within our program, and I oversee them. We started off just in Sarasota, where I am, and then we've grown it over the years, 13, 14 years, and we've got a pretty large phase one program. So all the patients that I see, I'm fortunate, I'm a clinical researcher, and all the patients I see are on trial. So I see all solid tumors and heme malignancies.
So you really don't have primary care of these patients. You're seeing them specifically for the trial. They are continuing with their primary doc.
All their care while is conducted by us in our group in the early phase trial unit. So if for example, if I'm the physician taking care of them, once they enter the trial, I take care of them while they're on the trial. So there are some things that we do locally to help the patients out, right? Whether it's labs or scans or supportive care, but all the treatment-related visits and all the trial-required visits for sure have to happen at our unit. And so and we handle almost all the care, because as you know, on these early phase trials, there's a lot involved, and the patients are need a lot of attention, so we take care of all that. So yeah, all the patients I see are on trial. If they have other visits that they need locally, they can we arrange that, but we take care of almost all their care while they're on trial.
And basically all the patients that you're managing are patients of FCS physicians?
Great question. So we're open, right? So we're open to the country, to the world. As you know, patients are much more educated nowadays and have much more access on finding treatment options and trials. And so we do have patients from outside the state, from outside the country. A lot of interesting targets. The field is moving so quickly that people want to participate in some of these trials, especially with the early promising results, right? And so I would say about 90% of our patients are from within our practice, just because we hear about more of those patients. But it doesn't mean that we don't hear about patients from all over, and including other centers within Florida.
Mm-hmm. You know, actually, it sounds like it must be a very interesting practice if you have these patients who are being managed. Then they come in, and as you say, now you're the prime. You have to kind of get involved in a primary way, managing them. And then I guess most of them end up leaving or going to another trial. But it sounds like a challenging situation, interesting situation for you in terms of the situations that you're seeing. Any thoughts about the type of trials that are being done now compared to 10 or 15 years ago? You know, people on the outside like us, we look at this and clearly industry is getting much more involved than they were 10, 15 years ago. But I'm not sure exactly in what way it seems like they're more involved with the common tumors, not so much with uncommon. I'm just kind of curious how you've seen that evolve, the industry, academic, sort of collaboration or research endeavors over the last 10, 15 years. It seems like a lot more industry now.
That's a great, great point. You're spot on. The field has evolved. It's become much more sophisticated, which is great, right, in terms of access to therapies and just, tolerability and science. And that's how we move things quicker. In terms of the type of trials, clearly the focus is taken away from the chemotherapeutic type of drugs, right? Now we have a lot more targeted therapies going after certain mutations, actionable mutations. Of course, the antibody drug conjugate field has taken off. And of course, the biggest field is immunotherapy. And so, you know, these, there's a lot more activity in those versus what we used to do 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years ago, right? So that, and then the care with those type of drugs is at a different level, right? So when it comes to immunotherapy, as you know, bispecific antibodies, BiTEs, right, CAR T trials, all of that require a lot more attention, a lot more involvement of clinical trial units, especially on the early phase side, where we're establishing management, dosing, side effects, and so on. So there's a lot more involvement, a lot more hospitalization. We're going backwards in time. Remember, we used to hospitalize most of these patients and a lot of the therapies, and now we went away from it. A lot of the drugs were given in an outpatient setting, and now we're kind of going back in the last several, 6-7 years, going back to the hospital for hospital observation. So there's a component of that on the trials now, where we're observing patients afterwards for safety and cytokine release syndrome. So that's different than the past. And then you're right about the industry versus investigator-initiated trials, right? That used to be a decent part of the trials that were out there, investigator-initiated trials, but there was so much activity going on within the pharmaceutical company, within pharmaceutical arena around the world, in terms of the number of new drugs that are being investigated. There's so many opportunities, so many drugs that a lot of the a good bulk of the trial menu at every center sponsor trials.
You know, another thing, and we've realized actually that when we do CME programs, up to 30% of the docs who are attending have been in oncology less than 10 years. A lot of them, you know, less than 5 years, and they really don't realize how much things have changed and how quickly. The other thing that it seems to me is occurring, and I think there's probably data on this, is that I think phase one trials 10 or 15 years ago, usually the chance that a patient would actually benefit was pretty unlikely, whereas now it seems like it happens a lot. Any thoughts about that and the fact that, you know, yes, you want to try to help future generations of patients, but a lot of patients benefit themselves from being in trials?
Absolutely. And as you know, there are multiple benefits of these type of trials. And the field has advanced so much, and so much is known about these targets and how to make drugs, and just the sophistication of those in the pharmaceutical companies, scientists, clinicians, that the drugs are more pure. And a lot of the hard work has been put in over several decades to get us to where we are now. And so you're right. We go into a lot of these early phase trials with a lot more expectations on efficacy, not only on the clinician side, right, patient side, but also on the pharmaceutical company side, right, on the industry side, where before, I mean, what's really interesting is before we would directly go from dose escalation cohorts right into expansion for these phase one trials or into a phase two trial, right? And now a lot of the decisions on even going to an expansion phase or a phase two trial, for example, is based on efficacy from what what the goals were from the dose escalation. So a lot of drugs the expectations are much higher now because of the successes that we're seeing on some of these early phase trials. And as you know, several drugs have been approved off of some of the phase one trials that became large in expansion phase. And so it's rewarding to be on this end of it, right? Where we're taking care of these patients and helping develop these drugs and seeing the number of advancements that are being made with these drugs. This is a great time to be part of drug development, phase one clinical trial work. But yeah, that's relayed to the patients. You know, they one of the biggest questions they have is, you know, what's been seen? What is the field showing with this target, with this drug? And the good thing now is there's a lot of companies that have come out with drugs that, will be a little different, but the same target, right? Or it could be the same target, they just done it better. And so there's a little bit more data now than what we had many years ago on these targets and what to expect. And the patients are just seeing that, right? There's so many drugs that are being approved, right? You've seen the number that have been approved in the last 5-10 years. They see that, they sense it, and they know that the field is moving very quickly. And they know to get access to these drugs, one of the main ways to get access to these drugs is on these early phase trials. And while there's patients who've had their cancers for double digit number of years, and while they've been getting treated for those cancers, they see approval after approval coming and they've seen the results of these trials and where is they started. Just pembrolizumab alone, right? Just that phase one trial alone, right? Really changed things. So, yeah, it's definitely helped the discussions and really led to a takeoff in the number of phase one trials being conducted and who's participating, right?
I'm also curious about some of the trends related to regulatory issues in the FDA. We can kind of get into that. But just to mention, though, that, you know, relevant to this issue of potential benefiting from being involved with research, we did actually a video presentation. I use videos rather than slides for FLASCO, Florida's, you know, Society mm-hmm. of Clinical Oncology, on disparities in oncology care and clinical trial accrual. And one of the things, one of the videos was a patient with myeloma who'd been doing great on teclistamab for a year and a half, and I interviewed him the day, that day I interviewed him was the day it was approved.
Yeah.
So he had been doing great amazing. For a year and a half the day it was mm-hmm. approved, and I couldn't come up with it. And that kind of also, I mean, we're not experts in disparities, but, you know, I hear things, so I'm just kind of curious. I know there's some kind of initiative coming out of the FDA involving disparities, like you need a, quote, disparity plan or something. I don't know mm-hmm. if that applies to phase one as well as other later phase. What is the FDA starting to do in terms of that?
Yeah, you're exactly right. It's a big focus of all early phase, late phase, because, you know, the continuum, these trials just go very quickly from one to the other. And so the companies, industry have to have a plan very early on what they're going to do to address diversity, right, disparities. So we're asked in the very beginning, you know, what are the plans? Each site is evaluated now when groups are being considered for particular trials. What is your plan with diversity and being able to enroll different populations? So we have to answer those questions from the site end as well. So the sites have to have a plan on access to these trials, to those populations. But of course, the pharmaceutical companies, as you mentioned, a little tougher for them because they have to they're directly answering to the FDA on what they've done and what their plans are to address it, even on an early phase trial end.
Well, I'll share with you, you may know this, but something that Paul Richardson from Dana-Farber discussed on a program we had. Actually, it was last summer, and then they presented this at ASH related to, I don't even remember, the big determination trial looking at transplant and myeloma, where they saw that African-American people didn't seem to benefit, and then they presented some stuff at ASH that maybe there's even a biologic basis with the Duffy-Nil thing, or I don't know, you know, sort of where that went, but the thing that was interesting was that they got, I think, 19% of the patients were African American, and I said, uh-huh. "What was your secret? How did you do it?" And he said, "African American oncologists," which I thought was very interesting. He even follows them when they move, so I thought it was interesting that angle to get the doc to be in the minority. I don't know if that's a strategy that you've used or thought about.
Wow, yeah, that's so tough, you know, to be able to recruit physicians that way, you know, that's, and also, you know, as you can imagine, taking care of patients and changing doctors to do that is very difficult. We try our best. I mean, every site does in the country in remembering this, and it's a big initiative from the sponsors' end, so we make it a point as well to constantly address it, and within our practices, we advertise and make it open. I mean, the good thing about our group is that we have pretty good diversity just in Florida alone, right? And as you
Absolutely.
Know, so it helps Absolutely. Us with that. But I can imagine around the other parts of the country that it's even more difficult. You know, luckily nowadays, there's a little bit more access to things that used to prohibit groups from enrolling in the trials. So no matter just distance alone, right? Before it would be sometimes a little bit more difficult for things to be covered for patients to participate in trials. And now travel is generally covered for most trials and pharmaceutical companies, I think it's because of this initiative, they realize that has to be in place. Translation of consent forms, really important to have that planned ahead of time. There was a time, it depends where you are in the country, depending on what populations you see, you may not have wanted to arrange or when they ask you up front, do you need translations of certain consents? And there's a lot of places in the country that would say, no, we don't need it. But now, as things have gotten faster with that process, most sites should be pushing for that, right, up front, so you don't have delays in getting certain populations on trials. So these are all things that are now in place that hopefully we're going to see the fruits of this down the road. And more data, like you said, there's you always wonder if certain populations benefit from certain therapies more and why. Right? You know, why are some toxicities? We've always had this interest in Asia versus the Western part of the world on why toxicities are different. Well, let's prove it on these trials, right?
I also wanted to ask you a little bit about what's going on in terms of the FDA in terms of a dosing, because I was mentioning this paper. You know, I guess there's a guidelines that came out of ESMO phase one study, the MDIC talking. But I've been hearing a lot about dosing. Even post-approval, like, for example, you know, like in breast cancer, dose modification in the adjuvant setting to be able to keep people on, you know, Abema or whatever. And I hear more and more emphasis on dose, post-marketing dose. What is the FDA kind of mandating to sort of get ahead of that? It seems like that's what they're trying to do.
Right. And as you've noticed over the years, we often find out as these trials progress and even after drug is approved, we realize sometimes that the dose may not have been solidified properly early on, right? And there's or the schedule. And so because of all the years of experience on how people actually dose a drug versus how it's part of the label has led to a big concentration on really trying to get it done right. Trying to get the dose right early on, and I support it. There's a lot more work involved in what the designs are nowadays or in the future. But basically, before once the MTD was reached in these early phase trials and the dose was established, all patients would just get that in the expansion phases, go on to phase two, phase three trials, and the drug would get approved, right? That would be the process. And those are based off small numbers in the phase one trials, right? I mean, the 3x3 traditional phase one design, you have 3 or 6 patients who clear a dose and you may go with that dose going into a large trial, right? And you find out later that it may actually have needed to be lower or higher, right? And so now, because of this Project Optimus, that the FDA, has initiated, what's being done now is going into the expansion phases or at the end of once the doses are established at the end of dose escalation phase one trials, now there's randomizations that are involved where you're pretty much having to study two doses instead of just going with one with a bulk of patients. Let's look at two doses from what you've learned in the trial and enroll a good number of patients in two. And so that more information, more data is obtained, and that will help future trials. So that does mean that trials will, especially phase one trials, will last a little longer. You know, there'll be more enrollment, more work is going to need to be placed, right? More infrastructure, the demand on moving things faster will have to slow down a little bit, right? But I think in the end, for the good of, you know, of the field, I think the doses will be established better and it'll be better for patients.
One of the questions I wonder about is there enough room for innovation in oncology research nowadays? Are we so slotted into this paradigm that we have, targeted therapy, immunotherapy, all the economics behind it? Are we leaving enough room for, you know, the creative geniuses or, you know, people with interesting ideas to get them vetted?
Yeah, it's a great point. I've often wondered the same thing, right? Especially in the immunotherapy world, people get fixated on certain pathways that we have to somehow make this an immune type of therapy. We have to have that angle for this to go anywhere. And you forget that there's so much untapped potential with other targets, things that we don't even know about. And if we put our resources and our efforts towards those pathways, those fields, we actually may come out a little further ahead, right? But once a certain, as you know, once a certain field takes off, everybody wants to be in it, right? And that's kind of where we're at with, for example, immunotherapy. There's a lot of pressure within the pharmaceutical, with funding for them, right? That's a big deal. And they're closing trials earlier now than they have in the past. And they need home runs early. They need some winners and some data efficacy early. And so when the field is very popular, very hot, you want to get in that because you think that gives you the highest chances of succeeding. But there's a lot of untapped areas in oncology, especially with the targeted, the targeted therapy is so rewarding on the clinical research side, right? When you find that, even if it's a rare mutation, when you find some of these things with low incidences and patients can really respond to these drugs, right? What other targets are we missing in our long NGS panels that we get, right? What other targets are we not making drugs for and why, right? We have a lot of smart people out there, a lot of resources.
So the other thing I was curious about is the issue of involving referring doctors in this process. As you mentioned, you're focused on the FCS docs, which is great. And incidentally, I don't know, are there other how many other phase one units are there like that with the volume? How many trials are you actually running right now?
Right. So we have a pretty large program. So we have about over 100 phase ones that are running at one time within our practice. The bulk of them are over here where I'm at. But we also have a phase two, phase three program at the same time. So at any one given time, we have a couple of hundred trials running at once, and just phase one, triple digits. It has its challenges, right? You're right. We're probably one of the few in the country that has this set up in a large practice. There are others that focus on phase one around the country that work with practices. Ones that are embedded in the practice and especially a physician owned, I think we're it. And so it does have its benefits and its challenges, right? Obviously our doc physician owned practice, our docs are heavily invested in patient care, and we're even though we have over 200 physicians in our practice, we communicate very closely, believe it or not, about patient care, and it does help to have that involvement, that interest on making things go well within a group, because you hear about more patients and patients like the fact that they stay in the same practice, right? The EMR, their scheduling, nurses, just the process. There's not a loss of information when people go to a center to participate in a trial. From another office, as you know, around the country, there's sometimes a loss of information or some inefficiency there, right? Where you have to now get records or you have to find out if you have this mutation or not. If it's in the same group, we have access to everything, right? Our charting is the same. So that does improve the efficiency of getting patients on trial, but also care. At the end of the day, you don't have a loss of information, so you can pick in the right treatment for the patient. And they don't lose the group that's been working with them for so many years, and patients like that. And what I like about our setup also is that we can order it's the same system, so I can order things on patients locally within their own practice while they're on trial with me. Maybe 3, 6, 7 hours away in the same state, and they can get their scans locally. There's a lot of things that we can do in their existing office, whereas in other centers around the country, they kind of have to do everything at that center. And it's very difficult for patients, especially the travel, right? So within the state, you can get to the longest that patients have to travel are 6, 7 hours. Everything else, so the bulk of our patients are within 2, 3 hours, the most of the patients that we enroll on trial. And we have a multiple phase one units now, so patients are able to get to these centers quicker, more efficiently, and their care is better.
I was just flashing on how successful it is in Germany to get people in trial, like all their patients go on trial. They get trials done just in Germany. It's like maybe Florida is going to become like Germany. Where you get a high fraction of people on trial. Really, my point is there's an advantage when you can concentrate on a smaller area. And you also, of course, are doing, you know, involved with phase two, phase three trials. You have Brad Monk that you just brought in. So you have a whole, uh-huh. you know, plethora of later line trials. How, at this point, globally, how effective you think you have been or the system has been in making these physicians aware of appropriate opportunities, or are they just so flooded with stuff that they can't keep, literally, that they really rarely can keep up with it and miss a lot of great opportunities?
Great question. So yeah, as every year that goes by, more and more drugs are getting approved, and it's harder just to keep up with the commercially available drugs, right? But the advantage that we have is, you know, we educate as much as we can on all these mechanisms, these drugs, and what's allowed, what's been seen with those drugs, and we have regular meetings within the practice where we have a research component, so docs get their education that way. But when you see your patient on a trial, let's say with us in our phase one unit, we update our docs every step of the way. Every scan, we're updating the referring physicians on how that patient's doing. And when you see responses, the first question that that referring doc may have in their head is, why? What's so neat about this mechanism? What are you seeing? And those are the conversations we have. And there are things that we explain up front anyways when we open up a new trial, and everybody knows our trial menu. But we try to educate as much as we can on mechanisms and why certain. And so the more patients you refer to some of these trials, the more you learn. It becomes repetitive, right? And, right. You know, it's been great to see a lot of the drugs that we've worked on in the phase one trials, especially the first-in-man trials, eventually get approved. And, you know, I've been very fortunate to see that process happen on double-digit number of drugs, and it's been very rewarding. And when the docs will remember that, they'll be like, oh, yeah, that's that trial that you had 7 years ago, and I remember my patient on that, and that it sticks in their head that patient's still in CR, right? And they remember that, our docs, our early phase docs, make it a point to remind them of that. So when these drugs are just, you know, are about to get approved or are approved, we'll point out to our docs, hey, you had. We'll call out the docs that referred patients to that drug once it got approved. You were part of that, you know, early process of getting the drug approved. So it is rewarding, but they remember it. And as you know, when patients and when physicians enroll or see their patients on a trial with a particular drug, once that drug gets approved, if you had enough experience with that drug, you're more likely to use that drug. If there's other similar drugs, you're more likely to go with the one that you did a lot of work with, right? Just from a comfort standpoint, right? And that exists on the standard of care side. You always go with the regimen that you're most comfortable with, right? And so that same thing happens when the drug gets approved. That experience of seeing your patients on these trials, even including patients who get referred to our unit, helps them when the drug comes out. And then we try to educate when the drug comes out. This is our experience. Hey, you know, this drug causes QT prolongation. You just be careful, watch the EKGs, or this is how we manage the nausea with this drug early on when we're creating the management guidelines, right? And little tricks, and that helps. So it does improve the quality of the practice, not only even if the drug doesn't get approved, right? What's out there.
Yeah, I think I saw some early work you were involved with the pirtobrutinib.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, we did that initial phase one.
One of my favorite topics. Such a cool drug.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. We were one of the first two sites to open that phase one trial, and I had many, many patients on that during the course of the phase one. They're still with me now, still responding very nicely. An amazing field in CLL and indolent lymphoma, despite having other therapies that came about, you know, that came about before it, just with a little change in the structure, right?
Really, really amazing. So one more thing just to mention, then we'll get down to the other stuff in terms of informing physicians. I thought I'd tell you about an experiment we did last week in a webinar. We had Andy Evans and Sonali Smith talking about lymphomas, our year in review mm-hmm. series. And one of the things they wanted to talk about, they have this new trial, phase three trial, limited stage Hodgkin. You know, they're trying to decrease intensity, less chemo, less radiation. They're bringing in Nevo, all et cetera, et cetera. But so I said, well, let's do an experiment in the webinar. So we did this experiment. First of all, we polled the audience and we said, have you ever heard of this study? You know anything about it? 85% of people said no. Mm-hmm. And then we spent 5 minutes talking about it. That's it. Just the two of them verbally. We hardly used any slides. They just explained the purpose for the study and why they did it. Then we went back and polled them again, and 88% of the docs said, yeah, I'd put a patient on that study. So it's, right. You know, I found it interesting that, you know, a certain kind, if you get the right combination of content, highly respected people, they've just spent the whole hour, you know they know what they're talking about, who present something in a clear, concise way. And in just, you know, 3 or 4 minutes, we had 88 docs ready to put people on trials. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, the last, as you know, post-COVID, you know, there's a lot more remote, virtual work that's being done, education. And we have lost a little bit in terms of interest. You can see that and just knowledge. And sometimes these in-person meetings, and you do a great job of this, the in-person meetings, you get a lot more accomplished, a lot more is learned, but the resources for that and the opportunities for that are less now than they were in the past. So that is a little downside of a lot of the virtual work that's being done out there, including trial enrollment. And so every center has to deal with that, where we're trying to educate physicians out there that there's a great trial that's available, and we're doing it via email mainly, right? Especially when you're trying to cast a broad net. Even if you participate in tumor boards, it'll be virtual because you're 6-7 hours away. But in the past, when we did it in person, and when we have our meeting in Orlando that with you, and we do all this at a different time after your session, and we do it, we go up at the podium. Next day, we hear about, hey, we have this patient for that trial. Well, we said the same thing last week via email. We didn't hear anything, right? So in person is so important.
So let's talk about B7-H3 antibody drug conjugates in terms of where we are and where we're heading.
So there's a lot of unmet needs within the therapeutic areas and oncology, and many targets have been identified, and B7-H3 has certainly become more popular in terms of therapies that are out there to target. B7-H3 is a transmembrane protein, and as you can see on this slide, we're showing all the current immune checkpoint receptors and their ligands. You can see on the top the tumor cells, APCs, and on the bottom the T cells. What's interesting about B7-H3, and it has a lot of immune interaction, but the receptor for B7-H3 has not been clearly identified. So B7-H3 ligand inhibits the activity of immune cells, so it serves a co-inhibitory function as well as a co-stimulatory function. So there's certainly many interactions that B7-H3 has and interactions with the immune system and immune cells. Besides the immune interaction, when B7-H3 is activated, it often increases the fibroblast proliferation, progression, migration, and inhibits apoptosis. When B7-H3 is activated, it promotes tumor cell growth, enhances tumor cell metastases, and plays a role in the modulation of cytokine secretion in many tumor microenvironment cells, and also through remodeling. So many interactions of B7-H3, not only on the immune side, but also the tumor microenvironment side. So B7-H3 ligand is overexpressed in multiple solid tumors. You can see her on this slide. But most, and we'll be going through this today, this includes prostate cancer, esophageal cancer, small cell lung cancer, squamous non-small cell lung cancer, and we'll go through some of the data on some drugs that target B7-H3 in those tumors. So speaking of B7H3, so there are antibody drug conjugates that have been developed to target B7H3. And this is one of them, ifinatamab deruxtecan, also known as DS7300. Was studied in this particular phase one trial, and I had the opportunity to participate in this trial from the very beginning, the first cohort. And we presented this at ESMO in 2023. So here's the structure of DS7300. Obviously, it involves a humanized B7H3 monoclonal antibody attached to a deruxtecan. So the payload is a topoisomerase 1 inhibitor, a potent payload linked with a stable, cleavable tetrapeptide-based linker. And this was the phase 1/2 study design that we conducted, that we presented at ESMO. Initially, patients with advanced, unresectable, or metastatic solid tumors were enrolled. These were unselected for B7H3, so over 200 patients were involved in this trial, and it's still ongoing. In terms of dose escalation, it moved all the way up to 16 milligrams per kilo, and 16 milligrams per kilogram was felt to be too toxic, and so 8 milligrams per kilo and 12 milligrams per kilo were further studied in certain populations. As you can see here, that there were three particular cohorts in the dose expansion phase: squamous esophageal cancer, metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer, as well as squamous non-small cell lung cancer. The primary, in terms of primary endpoints and dose escalation, DLTs, of course, treatment-related adverse events and adverse events of special interest. And of course, the dose expansion, overall response rate, duration of response, progression-free survival, and overall survival was followed. So, in terms of the efficacy results, we're showing the subset populations. Small cell lung cancer, in terms of this population within the phase one trial, was certainly remarkable. As you can see here, although small numbers, 21 patients in the efficacy population, the sponsor determined that anything of 4.8 milligrams per kilo or above was the efficacious or efficacy population. So there was about 21 patients when they went back and looked at it. So small numbers. However, almost every single patient had reduction of disease, as you can see here in the waterfall plot. Around 52% overall response rate. The median progression-free survival in this small population was 5.6 months, but the median overall survival was 12.2 months in this extensive stage small cell lung cancer population that was refractory to prior therapy. So pretty impressive for this group. Within the squamous esophageal cancer group, you can see here, once again, small numbers, 28 patients, but you can see at the waterfall plot and the overall response rate on the far right, about 21% in that population, overall survival of 7 months. And this was a relatively heavily pretreated population, a median number of prior lines of 4, and with metastatic esophageal cancer. And this was, you know, this is kind of the target that we see with all B7H3 agents is the metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer population. You can see a good number of patients were part of this subset in this trial, 73 patients that were just part of the efficacy population. And as you can see here, it's hard to, you know, it's more and more difficult to find these patients with measurable disease with prostate cancer. But certainly of the patients that had it on this trial, you can see the overall response rate of 25%. And then of the patients who had liver mets, which I find very interesting, 33% there was 33% overall response rate. So, you know, biopsies were not performed on this population prior to coming on trial. So we don't truly know how many of these may have had neuroendocrine features, for example. But, you know, when you see patients with liver mets and with metastatic prostate cancer, as responding in this fashion, it's certainly exciting. Median overall survival with this group was 13 months in a heavily pretreated population. You can see there the number of prior systemic therapies was 6 in this phase one trial. Median progression-free survival is 5.3. So we're seeing this kind of activity with other B7H3 targets, and certainly was displayed here in our ESMO presentation. And within our squamous non-small cell lung cancer population, small numbers, 13 in the efficacy population, but you can see here, certainly there was activity there. Overall response of 30%, duration of response 4 months. But, once again, these patients had a median of 3 prior lines. There's more that's going to be studied with this population as well. Here's an overall safety summary for this particular phase one trial with this B7H3 antibody drug conjugate. In the far right, you can see the total in terms of safety. And, a high percent of these patients will experience adverse events. And you can see here a grade 3 or higher, whereas 43% treatment emergent. The percent of patients that discontinued, though, was only 8%. Dose interruptions about 22% of the overall population, and about 10% with dose reduction. There was only one death in the data that was displayed in this presentation, and that was due to interstitial lung disease. You can see here, of course, the small cell lung population numbers were slightly higher, as you would expect in a tougher population. And here are the particular adverse events that we see with this particular B7H3 antibody drug conjugate. As you can see on the far right, the percentage, the incidence is there. And nausea, anemia, and infusion-related reactions were seen to a degree of 30% or higher. Nausea eventually on this particular trial, I know it's not on this slide, but we eventually implemented antiemetics, prophylactic prior to dosing for all patients. Interestingly, a lot of patients, including the ones that I treated, had delayed nausea. So not so sure if the pre-med antiemetics will help those patients, but it was implemented on the trial, and that did seem to help to a degree. But in terms of the infusion-related reactions, that was also later on. Pre-meds of dexamethasone were implemented, and it did seem to improve tolerability. And, whenever you have a target, including the antibody drug conjugates, the biggest question is, okay, what is the target? What is the expression? Does expression matter? And how much matters, right? There's so many therapies now with antibody drug conjugates that are out there. What percent really matters in terms of response? Well, this was all retrospective, so this wasn't pre-planned. And they tried to obtain as much tissue as possible to do these analyses because everybody wants to know these answers, right? And so on the far right, you can see this is just with the small cell lung population B7H3 expression just in these samples didn't appear to matter. You can see here that the overall response rate was not higher in patients who had higher B7H3 expression. The PFS, the median overall survival, they were not higher in patients who had a higher expression in the small cell population that had, as you saw, really interesting responses. And the same thing was seen in the metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer population. Historically, the higher the B7H3 expression, it's thought that it's usually correlated with higher Gleason scores, higher staging, more metastatic disease, more castration-resistant population. In this group, although still small numbers relatively, right? 62 samples, 62 patients. Once again, a high B7H3 expression did not correlate with higher PFS, higher overall survival, and higher overall response rate. So, interesting. This will have to be obviously followed, and other groups are following this with their compounds as well. So, more is to be learned. So this is an ongoing phase two trial in the small cell lung cancer population, an extensive stage. These are patients who are refractory to platinum-based therapy, or I should say who have received platinum-based therapy in the past and have not received more than 3 prior lines of therapy. The primary endpoint for this particular trial, this ongoing phase two trial, is objective response rate. And so, as you can see here, as we were talking about earlier, Neil, this is an example of what's being done with dosing, right? Where two doses are being explored within this particular phase two, where patients are going to be randomized to 8 mg/kg versus 12 mg/kg, which were the two identified doses that were seen in the phase one part of the trial.
So, I guess people might have been thinking in the past that it might have been randomized one dose versus some other therapy, you know, lurbinectinib or something. I guess you can't really go to three arms in a phase two. But do you think this is like a trend? You know, do you think that maybe, or are you going to then take the optimal dose and then do another randomized phase two, or can you go right to phase three?
Yeah, to be honest, this was probably planned this was planned a while back. Right. So now what we're seeing is we're seeing this embedded into the phase one, right, where these doses are established before a subsequent trial that's being developed to then randomize to standard of care therapy or some other therapy, right? So this particular design is being done in the phase two, but we're now doing this within the phase one trials.
Yeah, I mean, also in this situation, the comparator, you know, standard of care is so bad that it looks like it would. I mean, I don't know if you need randomized data to approve it, but I'll bet it that even a one arm study will look way better than lurbinectinib. I mean, I guess. I don't know. What do you think?
Absolutely. No, I think there's certain comparative drugs that you have a feeling ahead of time that would probably in a higher chance of moving the drug forward.
Yeah, like chlorambucil, you know,
when chlorambucil comparative trials or sorafenib.
Right, sorafenib. But just to backtrack, though, in terms of what happened here with the this new agent, I think it's really interesting in terms of the fact. So I guess the way you conducted this trial, would you say in general it's the way you normally would do a phase, you know, this kind of early stage phase one, phase two study? But I guess my question is, I'm not sure when it was originally conceived, but obviously with a DXD payload, you got a whole bunch of things to think about if you think it's relevant, nausea and vomiting, ILD, et cetera. So did what they look at or what you looked at safety-wise, was that guided by previous experience with other similar ADCs like TDXD? Did they do a lot of lung screening, for example?
Absolutely. So, as you've mentioned, any trial that's being developed nowadays with an antibody drug conjugate, they're built in now where certain criteria have to be met in screening that will very precautiously exclude any possibility of any confusion, for example, with potential of ILD later. So there's screening procedures. They can't have certain findings on the scan during screening. If there's ever a concern of even a small potential of confusion with the future pneumonitis or a potential to, you know, that's a higher risk of pneumonitis, those patients are excluded now. And so it does make enrollment and screening on trials a little bit more difficult, but it's important to answer those questions, and a lot more is done to mitigate those risks.
So another thing that's been really interesting, particularly about TDXD as it goes into other tumor types, we did a program at the GU symposium a couple weeks ago, and one of the modules was on HER2-positive, you know, bladder cancer, and I couldn't find any urologic oncologist who had significant experience with TDXD, so I actually brought in a breast person to say, like, mm-hmm. What do they do? Not necessarily that that's what they had to do, and one of the things that came out that I wanted them to see, because when I was asking them, they did not know about it, was what you were talking about before, which is the acute GI toxicity, chemo-like toxicity, which I don't think was appreciated that much in the beginning with TDXD. First, the breast people got it. I'm not even sure the lung people even have it at this point. But the idea that, it was labeled as a severely emetogenic drug. I mean, I saw the GU people react to that 2 weeks ago. They didn't know that. So, for example, you know, it looks like this trial, it was evolving as we were learning that. But I guess my question is, do you have any sense about, like, I'm not sure whether TDXD causes more GI toxicity than, for example, Dato-DXD. I didn't hear that much about it. But this drug, mm-hmm. did it seem like it was severely emetogenic?
I wouldn't use the word severely because our the regimens that we were using to prevent it and to treat it were not what we do with other severely emetogenic drugs. But the risk is there. So this was actually pretty manageable, to be honest. And what's really interesting about this particular drug, which is that it seems to improve as with further treatment. So most of the patients, for example, that I had on this drug, and we had a good number of patients on this, is that most of the nausea and vomiting occurred in the first several cycles. And very interestingly, those high percent of those patients came off antiemetics later. Huh. After 4 or 5 cycles. So you have to get them through the first several cycles and they know when to take their ondansetron and so on. But they really didn't need much more past ondansetron, to be honest. It was manageable with this particular drug.
Another thing is that you didn't actually show data on lung complications. Were there any I know there's one death there. Was the incidence of ILD?
Yeah, up to this data cutoff, there was only a few patients who have had ILD pneumonitis on the trial. There was one death, as you mentioned, and this is going to be obviously focused on in this particular phase two, but also the phase three trial that we're about to show as well.
So one other question I had, which is you were referring to neuroendocrine cancers, you see in the bladder and other places. I'm curious in general, do drugs that work with small cell work? I mean, I see the docs using it. I'm not sure how much data there is. And from your point of view, I mean, could you get a bladder patient to be treated with this, for example?
Yeah. Unfortunately, a lot of these trials are specific for certain cancers, and they don't have a broad, indication of or allowing any neuroendocrine tumor. There seems to be an expression difference in different organs, which is why some of these trials will say, small cell lung only. So we are restricted in terms of the data and what we know. I do agree. I wish we would expand some of these trials to allow, if we're seeing nice data with a small cell lung population, have we explored and do we truly know how much expression is needed elsewhere, whether it's GI, neuroendocrine tumors, or like you mentioned, GU and so on. So there's not enough data, unfortunately, because people are the field is really trying to move a drug forward in some of these unmet need, disease groups like small cell lung, right? And the focus ends up just being on that. But the incidence and the population, the number of patients who have the other ones are so small that I imagine that plays a role in deciding what diseases and what effort is placed on within that trial, right?
Well, it also gets into, kind of what's the criteria going to be for tumor agnostic approval? Mm-hmm. I mean, Pembro with, as, one thing, Dab-Trem for BRAF is another thing, but agents like this, ADCs, like I just can't figure it out how they're going to do that. Like even just TDXD to start with. I mean, mm-hmm. you see HER2 positive, there are too few of so many different, and now they're already out to biliary, but there's even others beyond that. Any thoughts? Has the FDA talked about like what their criteria is going to be for pan-tumor approvals?
Yeah, it's a great question. We struggle with that on the trial end as well, where we're looking ahead and we're trying to make a decision what trials to bring, right? And some of the targets with the antibody drug conjugates require expression testing. Now that's a big part of what's being involved in the requirements to even get on these phase one antibody drug conjugates that you have to test the tumor. Well, these are not commercially available testing. Tests that are done, for example, B7H3 or other targets, right? So now these samples are having to be sent to the sponsor, which takes sometimes several weeks, versus HER2 and other some other therapies where you can do the it's very standard to do those testing local, locally, right? So it does make it a little bit more difficult now, even on the trial end, for these antibody drug conjugates, because now it's pretty much a requirement to test that, and it's done by the sponsor. Hopefully, as these drugs evolve, then you expect them to be now part of a commercial testing. But how do you do that outside of an NGS panel, right? You have to start involving local. Now the pathology offices now have to start doing the testing for these maybe low incidence, markers. And so it's really going to up the ante on these vendors on what they're able to do with that tumor tissue, not only NGS, but a whole array of IHC testing is going to have to be a big part of what we do in the future. We send off an NGS order on a tissue sample, and we want not only a full NGS panel, but we want a set of IHC, a set of markers to be done all with IHC because of drugs like this for antibody drug conjugates, if expression matters, if you prove it later.
So, that would be interesting to see in terms of what you actually end up showing. And I guess your next slide, I'm not usually a wagering person. I was sure that data was going to be positive, but it wasn't as positive as I thought it was going to be. But I don't know. I can't imagine this is not going to be a positive trial. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with you. When you have a comparison arm with topotecan, the lurbinectedin, and then amrubicin in the Asian countries, there's a better shot than prior years, right?
But you never know. And, also right. The other thing is sometimes you see things you don't expect. Like all of a sudden, Dato, I hear about mucositis. Of course, that was known. Mm-hmm. Ophthalmic issues, which I never heard about in lung cancer before. And now all of a sudden, we got not just the drugs you're talking about. You got other drugs. And tarlatamab, the bispecifics and small cell. It looks like small cell is going to be kind of hot in the next couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been waiting for a lot more development, and small cell ovarian is getting there too, right? But small cell, certainly there's a lot of activity, and especially with this target with B7H3. But yeah, this is a phase 3 trial in the relapsed small cell lung population. And the primary endpoint is going to be objective response rate and overall survival. Certainly there's a lot of excitement about this. But we learned a lot, not only in terms of these primary endpoints, but also safety. Phase 1s are done at centers that are very used to managing some of this toxicity very quickly. Once trials like this roll out, is it as safe and well managed? Is it manageable out in the community and other centers that may not be involved in some of the phase 1 trials? Because when we're seeing these reactions, for example, you saw the numbers with this, there's over 30% infusion-related reactions. Those get handled very quickly because we know it's coming, right? But when you do these trials outside, is it as manageable? And are you seeing a little worse outcomes? And will that affect the positivity, how we have viewed the results of this trial? Yeah, I agree with you.
I've been joking with the lung cancer people that actually, in terms of cytokine release, which I think you see with CD3 bispecific, I think you see it with tarlatamab. But I was telling them the oncologists are going to be ready for you because we already have bispecifics with CD3 bispecific in myeloma and lymphoma. So hopefully that'll be straightened out. And speaking of that, I assume your units are fully able to handle CRS and everything else related to that?
Yeah, absolutely. We've been doing bispecific antibody trials for several years now, 6-7 years now, since the beginning of those when those drugs were being developed. And we had to do that. Every center in the country had to do that, where some of the transplant centers had a little easier time, right, because they had the hospitalization procedures already in place. But and I'm really proud of our units to be able to figure this out as an outpatient when you're not directly connected to a hospital. How do you work with your go-to hospital? And we have a great one nearby. And how do you work with that? And we've had to establish the processes and management and when to call for what and cytokine release syndrome management. And these are now flows and order sets for all of that which made it very easy. Every trial that we brought on, everything was set in place, and whether it was at our unit for cytokine release management or in the hospital. And then once the drugs became commercially available within the last year or two, right? Now the hospital is just used to doing it. And so it certainly has helped make everybody more comfortable when it was already established on the clinical research side, right?
Right. I'm curious, too, though, in terms of that question, not to get too far off the topic, but, for example, do you feel like all the FCS offices are able to handle cytokine release? Do they carry tocilizumab?
Yep, tocilizumab. So we are in the process of identifying, and we have identified, but in terms of initiating the process, and this is going on all over the country, I'm sure every group is thinking about this, is which offices are best suited to do this. And so some of our offices that have more infrastructure in place, more staffing, do a lot of the clinical trial work already that may already have some of this. Those are the ideal offices, right? Ones that are near hospitals in case when you give tocilizumab in the office or you need more monitoring, we'll have a hospital right next to the office that can take over, right? So we've already started doing it within our practice, identified offices, and patients have already been dosed commercially. But a lot of work goes into making sure you identify the right group, but also the right physician and the right staff, because you have to have go-to people to help manage this and lead that within the office, because it's going to happen, you know, 3-4 hours after dosing, right? And so the patient could be just sitting there, but you have to have all that in place. We've already started doing that. And once you do it once you have that infrastructure, that plan for with a couple of offices, you can then expand it to multiple. And that's what other offices are waiting for, right? But you got to do it in a stepwise fashion.
So I am curious, like this planning process you're talking about, was that done more informally, or is there some process within FCS that you can sit down as a group and say, okay, let's figure out how we're going to deal with CAR or bispecifics?
You're exactly right. So everything goes well when you have a form committees and plan, right? So yeah, for sure. A lot of the personnel that are involved in drug administration within our practice, because we have over 100 offices, right? We have to have a team. We already have a team already in place for just overseeing drug administration in all the offices. So that team was already, it was natural for them to take on this role. And okay, how are we going to give these, this was discussed years ago, right? Because the luxury with our practice is that we were already seeing these being studied on the clinical research end. And we were telling everyone, hey, we're using tocilizumab every day, right? Be ready in 3-4 years. We might have to start using this and having a process in place in other offices. So that's another benefit of clinical trials, right? Where you're able to educate everybody else and foresee what's coming. And so we've already had those groups in place, the leaders within drug administration, pharmacy, already in place planning for this with local hospitals, but also our own offices and identifying people. So yeah, it's truly, there's a planning process that has to be done way ahead before you start doing this.
Really interesting. I meant to ask you before, if you get a typical NGS assay right now, do you get a B7H3 readout?
No, unfortunately, it's not commercially available. And so if you're involved in the trials, these drugs are only available on clinical trials, right? So the sponsors are the ones who are arranging testing for that. Mm-hmm.
But for this trial, it looks like you don't need to be tested. I mean, you need to be tested, but it is not a requirement to be positive
up front
to enter.
Correct. Right. Yeah. So far, there's not enough data to suggest that to stratify patients based on expression.
All right. Please continue.
Yeah, sure. So another compound that's been studied on phase one trials is MGC018. It's another B7H3 antibody drug conjugate. And this was also presented at ESMO in 2021 by Dr. Shenderoff. And MGC018 eventually was named bromomitinemab, duocarmazine. As you can see here from the name, duocarmazine is the cytotoxin, is the payload for this particular B7H3 antibody drug conjugate. So within this trial with vobramitamab, this phase one trial, typical dose escalation followed by an expansion phase, in particular, metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer, as well as non-small cell lung cancer. And the primary endpoint, of course, in this phase one trial was safety and tolerability. And within this population, here's some subsets, some data. And as we've seen with other metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer trials with B7-H3 antibody drug conjugates, you see here reduction in tumor within this population for the ones that actually have measurable disease. And obviously, there are several patients when this data came out that were still ongoing. And then this is always an impressive curve, impressive graph that we see with all these B7-H3 antibody drug conjugates is the change in the PSA. And we see that with this particular B7-H3 ADC. And you can see here PSA 50 changes in a high percent of patients. And the same trend is was seen with this trial in non-small cell lung cancer. And here's the overall safety with vobramitamab, duocarmazine, in this particular phase one trial. Similar to other ADCs, a high percent of these patients will have adverse events. However, as you can see here, only 7% on this trial, a small number, right, 86 patients in this particular data set, 7%, only 7% needed to be discontinued due to an AE, 20% needed dose reductions, and about 45 didn't need to be interrupted, though. And here are the particular adverse events with this particular B7-H3 ADC. As you can see here, fatigue, but really cytopenias are the bigger ones with this particular ADC, neutropenia, anemia, thrombocytopenia, and the rest is there, all related to the cytotoxin, the payload, nausea, pleural effusion, round up the rest of the AEs there in terms of grade 3 or higher. There's a different way of looking at this. And as you can see here, most of the adverse events were low grade, right? Grade 1, grade 2, in terms of treatment-related adverse events. Small numbers in terms of grade 3 or higher, but certainly manageable. So here's the ongoing phase 2 trial looking in the metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer population. We're once again randomizing two different doses, 2.0 mg per kilo and 2.7 milligrams per kilo. And the primary endpoint here is radiographic progression-free survival in this prostate cancer population. Up to one prior docetaxel-containing regimen is required in terms of eligibility. And the patient's going to be stratified based on visceral disease, prior taxane, and region. And lastly, this is the third compound that we'll talk about. It's another B7-H3 antibody drug conjugate, HS20093. And similar to some others, the payload is a topoisomerase 1 inhibitor. This escalation design, as you can see here, is very similar to others that we've talked about today, where 8 milligrams per kilo and 12 milligrams per kilo were the doses that were moved forward. And then in the expansion phase, typical non-small cell lung cancer, small cell metastatic castration-resistant prostate cancer, and so on, were studied. And here are the baseline characteristics, as well as the safety and tolerability. Similar to others, based on the payload, the cytotoxin, the dose-limiting toxicities were cytopenias, as you would expect. The MTD was found to be 12 milligrams per kilo. Most of the adverse events that were seen with this drug, similarly to others, were all low-grade, not too many grade 3 or grade 4 events with this particular antibody drug conjugate. Here's some efficacy results. Small numbers, right? But similar to what we've seen with other compounds, non-small cell lung cancer, small cell lung cancer were certainly areas that showed some interesting efficacy, as you can see here in the waterfall plot. Objective response rate of 64%, median progression-free survival of 4.7 months in a heavily pretreated population. And on the right, you can see the small cell lung data. Small numbers, but you know, trend is going towards what we've seen with other compounds. And this is an ongoing phase two trial with this compound, this particular B7H3 ADC HS20093. This is in the treatment naive population, so extensive stage small cell lung cancer population, where the primary endpoint is going to be an objective response rate up to 18 months. And then the key secondary endpoints will be PFS, overall survival, and duration of response, and safety, of course. But yeah, this is up front now, so you know, the field is certainly moving quickly.
Up front, small cell, like they're not going to get chemo?
Yeah, that's the way this is designed. I'm not, we're not participating in this particular trial, but this is the way it looks like it's designed. Yes.
It's interesting. I mean, you know, like if you kind of view it as a window kind of trial, maybe, you know, if they're, I don't know how many people are asymptomatic with metastatic small cell, but I could see it like a window trial, maybe, if they were asymptomatic, which I don't know.
Asymptomatic, anyhow, a certain population.
Yeah, like, small cell, asymptomatic. But anyhow, a couple of final things just to sort of bring it together. One thing, you know, kind of, I'm just kind of curious, like the, you talked about three different ADCs with the same target. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more data in the first one that you talked about. But I just wonder if you could kind of like capsulize, and just as an example of how you view, you know, research in progress, how do you view these three ADCs at this point in time? Like, well, this one, you know, looks like it's almost, you know, it looks like it's very likely to be beneficial. This one, it's way, way too early, but this, the toxicity looks good. Like any sort of capsulized view of, even though I know you're not necessarily participating in all these, but what's your view of them in terms of where they're at?
Yeah, we're participating in two of those three, and the first two for sure. And there's a lot of combination work, in particular with the second drug, with other immune agents, PD-1, CTLA-4, bispecific antibodies. And so there are ongoing trials with that. So more is to come as far as where these drugs will be. Very exciting, all three. I mean, I think that's the overall general consensus, right? You're seeing nice efficacy, generally manageable, and we just need more numbers, right? We need more data from these planned ongoing trials, but I think they're all equally exciting. I think one, obviously, there's one that's the first one is a little further ahead, right, than the others, and really the numbers are going to be higher with when the trials you're going to get more data for trials that are larger, and which is what we see, which we saw with the first ADC. So it's hard to compare all three, right? You know, who knows if with more data if the other two are going to have as much efficacy as the first, but I think they're all equally exciting and all manageable, right?
Any thoughts? This comes up, you know, in bladder cancer, where first line therapy now is ADC plus IO, you know, and fortimab and pembrolizumab. Any thoughts? You know, there's situations like that where it looks like ADC plus IO is better than chemo plus IO, even though ADCs are supposed to be chemo, targeted chemo. Do you think that's the case, that in some way you're seeing like some synergy with the ADC that you might not see, you know, with, you know, other agents? And do you think there's a mechanism that explains why an ADC might be more effective combined with an IO?
Yeah, I think it's certainly an area of interest and really trying to explain. Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with tolerability, right? I mean, some of these ADCs are much easier to combine with other agents, which is why the combination trials have taken off, and why perhaps we're going to be using a lot more of that, those combinations than chemo IO combinations, you know. And so I think that's why we're seeing a lot more a movement for an interest on combinations with ADCs, because it's just easier to do. These drugs are tolerated better. In terms of efficacy, there really isn't data to suggest why. You know, if there's true synergy, I think a lot of the combination data that we see is a lot of additive properties, right?
Right.
But certainly better tolerated than what we would traditionally see with chemo combinations, which is why these combos are making it, right? But to your point, I think these type of compounds and others in terms of the antibody drug conjugate family will start surfacing and moving from the refractory metastatic population earlier and earlier and earlier, like we're seeing, as you mentioned, in the bladder population, right? And so we're going to start seeing that in other diseases. And those trials are ongoing right now, first line, right? And so that's an exciting field. And I do foresee a lot of these making it in that arena, in the right population, once we can target who that drug is best for. I think that's going to be the key.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Patel, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.